Shrink Wrap Radio number 522, Saving Psychotherapy from the Brink, with Dr. Ben Caldwell.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Los Angeles-based psychotherapist Dr. Ben Caldwell, who is the author of the 2016 book Saving Psychotherapy: How Therapists Can Bring the Talking Cure Back from the Brink. For more information about Dr. Ben Caldwell, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Before we go to the interview, let me mention that this week's featured article in The Neuropsychotherapist is Rhythms, Sleep, and Dreams by David Presti. You'll find it at neuropsychotherapist.com, which is the beautifully illustrated online monthly magazine for psychotherapists and anyone else interested in the intersection between the latest neuroscience findings and psychotherapy. I want you to go to neuropsychotherapist.com and get your free introductory issue today. And I'm hoping that will inspire you to support their superlative work by subscribing to it. Today's show is also brought to you by Bombas.com. Save 20% off your first order at www.getbombas.com/shrinkwrapradio. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Ben Caldwell, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, it's really good to have you here. You were actually recommended to me by a listener, Jan Prin. I don't know if that name rings a bell for you, but I think he saw you on somebody else's podcast. I can't believe there are other people out there doing that. But I went and, on his advice, I checked out that podcast, which was an interview with you, and it was a really fine interview, a fine podcast. And so I thought, hey, I got to get this guy on the show.
So, well, thanks. I appreciate that. And thanks to Jan, too.
Yeah. So here we are. Now, before we get into your book, which we are here to discuss, maybe you can tell us a bit about what drew you to becoming a psychotherapist and then about your training.
Sure. Well, nobody picks this field at random, right? We don't throw darts at a dartboard and decide to become therapists. My parents got divorced when I was really young. So I don't really have any childhood memories of them together as a couple. I'll say to their credit that they handled the divorce and the divorce process really, really well. So for my brother and me, we never heard them speak ill of each other in front of us, which I think was a very good and important and helpful thing that they did.
Sure.
That also meant that we never really got an explanation of what happened and why our parents weren't together while our friends had parents who were together. So that led me into this real fascination with relationships and especially with couple relationships. And so I sort of took that through my education and came out to California for graduate school. I got my master's and doctorate at what is now Alliance International University in San Diego. And here I am. I've been licensed for, I guess, about 12 years now.
Okay. Well, you've written this very provocatively titled book, Saving Psychotherapy, How Therapists... a second here. I lost part of my view. let me back up again and say, Saving Psychotherapy, How Therapists Can Bring the Talking Cure Back from the Brink. That's a scary sounding title. Before we get into the contents of it, though, I was struck by the maturity of your view, even though of the stance that you took, even though you've been in the field now for 12 years, and that definitely counts for something, but still, there was such a maturity and sophistication in your overview that really impressed me. And so,
well, thank you.
Yeah, you should be like 60. And you will
be. I appreciate that. That's kind of you. I'll tell you, I think that sort of what this book required, the zooming out of the lens, is something that I hadn't done as much of earlier in my career. And I kind of explain in the book about how and why that started, that particularly for this book. But I will say that some of the policy work I've been doing in the past 10 years is related in the sense that my training, my education is systemic in nature. I'm a family therapist by licensure. My clinical specialization is in doing couple therapy. So I look at systems. I look at how systems are impacted by sort of various forces. And to me, policy work is just very much an extension of that. Instead of looking at the rules and roles that sort of govern a couple or a family, it's just looking at the rules and roles that govern you know, a profession or a society. And in Saving Psychotherapy, it's sort of an application of the same systemic principles, trying to zoom the lens out far enough to see kind of where we're situated in it and how we can influence and be influenced by these other forces that impact our field.
Yeah, well, I think most therapists are so focused on building and maintaining their practice and the day-to-day demands of the profession that they don't pull back, a whole lot of them don't pull back in the way that you have. And mm-hmm. as you say, there's some experiences that you've had that have helped prepare you to do that, both your orientation as a systemic thinker, as you mentioned, but also you mentioned a couple of committees that you've been on.
Yeah. So I've done work now for quite a long time for the AAMFT California Legislative and Advocacy Committee.
And that'd be what, American Association for Marriage Family Therapists?
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
And I like to tell the story of how that started because I think it's relevant to the therapist or the student who right now is thinking, you know, I'd like to get involved in some of this stuff, but I don't know how. I went to a meeting in 2004, 2005, sometime around then, where it was the retreat for the year for AAMFT California, sort of officials, board members, and the elections committee and that kind of thing. I had just gotten onto the elections committee, which is sort of a nice low-level post within the organization. And it came up at this meeting that they needed some new blood on their legislative and advocacy committee. The person who had been running that committee was ready to step down. They needed some new people to be involved. At that time, I was also getting ready to make a move to Sacramento. I was going up there to teach for my university. And so I sort of put my hand up and said, I actually would be interested in serving on that committee. I don't know the first thing about legislation or advocacy, but I care. I'm interested in, you know, whatever kind of rules and laws are going to impact our field and the clients that we work with. So
you do care, I have to say. That's interesting that you said that, and I just want to underscore it because that really comes through in the book. Pardon my interruption. You can keep
going. No. I'm glad to hear that comes through so well.
It really does.
So I said, well, I care. I'll be on that committee. And they said, great, you're the chair. And so I thought, oh, maybe I should not have volunteered.
Yeah, right. Well, actually, I think the volunteering served you well. And there was another committee on a different organization. Just quickly, what was that?
Actually, I'm not sure what you're referring to.
I'm not either. I thought I remembered that, and then I didn't go back in the book to double check that memory, which probably would have been a good idea.
Well, I will tell you, I've gotten the opportunity to work on a handful of different committees for different organizations, and it's been a real privilege getting all of that experience. So most of my work has been through the AAMFT California Legislative and Advocacy Committee, but I've also done things like I've been on a work group for the larger national AAMFT. I served on their ethics code revision task force.
That's probably what I was thinking of. Well, let's dive into the book. And you start off making a rather strong statement saying that therapy works incredibly well, but fewer people are going. So both parts of that sentence contain important assertions. in such a short sentence. So first, what is some of the evidence that therapy works incredibly well?
Well, I'm glad to say that we now have decades, really, of meta-analytic evidence that most people who go to therapy experience positive change as a result. The effect size from psychotherapy is pretty powerful, actually much more powerful than a number of other well-accepted medical interventions. One of the examples I use in the book is aspirin for reducing heart attack.
Yeah.
Well-accepted medical intervention, actually very small effect size. Now, powerful enough to be worth it and to be cost-effective, but the effect size of psychotherapy is much, much larger. And so we know from study after study after study over many, many years that therapy works. If you look at cost-effectiveness, therapy has what's called an offset effect, where the amount of money that an insurer, for example, spends on psychotherapy, they are going to more than recoup in somebody being healthier after they've gone to therapy. So there's a bunch of different ways to measure this, but the short version is ultimately psychotherapy is really powerful. There's no room left to debate that at this point.
Do you think the general public has gotten that message?
No, I think there is an awful lot of misconception still in the general public about what it is that therapists do and how effective we are. And I do talk in the book about there's some reasons for that. I mean, there's some reasons for those misconceptions that we have some responsibility for.
Yeah, yeah, we'll be getting into that.
That message is not universal.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the second part of that sentence, because I was not aware that fewer people are going to therapy. Here in Sonoma County, where I live, it seems like you can't throw a rock without hitting a therapist of one stripe or another. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think that this local area might be oversaturated with therapists. But I'm also aware that many young therapists may not have as many clients as they would like. And sometimes I've joked that therapists, that their practice consists of seeing other therapists. There are some issues, but you report that, that fewer people are seeking therapy. And since reading your book, actually, I saw something, the current APA monitor, that would seem to substantiate that as well. But tell us a little bit more about that, because in a way, it's shocking.
It is surprising. I mean, we'd sort of expect with all the improvements in access to mental health care that have taken place over the past 15 to 20 years, parity laws and technology and so forth, that more people would be taking advantage of their newfound access to mental health care. But they're not. The number of people who are accessing outpatient psychotherapy on an annual basis is sort of not greatly, but steadily declining. And that's really worrisome, especially considering the policy decisions that have been made to try to expand access. Does that mean that these policies haven't been working? Does that mean that there are other things standing in people's way of going to therapy? But we do have very strong federal level data that says fewer people are going.
And what's been the impact of this decline in therapy use on the amount of money that therapists can earn? Is this impacting the profession at that level?
Absolutely, yeah. So therapists of all types, and I talk mostly in the book about psychologists, MFTs, social workers, and counselors, but all kinds of psychotherapists are making less money. Our salaries are decreasing relative to inflation. And actually, just a couple of months ago, the most recent data came out for, I think, 2015. And that data showed a little bit of a track back upward. We haven't sort of caught up to where we were 10 years ago, but a little bit of a bump back upward, which was sort of a surprise, and I'm not sure what meaning to put it to. But overall, we're making less money. Part of the reason that is really troubling is because our training has gotten so much more expensive, which I know we're going to get to.
Yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact, young therapists have accumulated huge amounts of debt, maybe not just young, but people who are entering the profession, both at some at the undergraduate level and then at the graduate level, and is kind of crushing debt, which, yeah. by the way, you can't declare bankruptcy to get out of, as far
That's
as
right.
I know.
After the changes in law from a couple of years ago, student debt is no longer dischargeable in bankruptcy proceedings.
Yeah, that is so short-sighted, in my opinion, but that's a whole nother talk.
I agree with you for what it's worth. It amazes me that, you know, for all the kinds of debt that people can understandably discharge, that we wouldn't make student debt dischargeable.
Yeah, education is a major engine for our economy.
Yeah.
And so it just seems to fly in the face of that.
Agreed. And student loan debt actually has a relatively low default rate. You know, while people build up incredible amounts of debt in undergraduate and graduate school, most people are actually able to make their appropriate debt service payments. I think the struggle that we're going to run into with new therapists coming into the field is with education being so expensive and so much debt built up and salaries declining relative to inflation, servicing that debt is going to take more and more and more of their income. And we're reaching a point, we're already seeing this, we are reaching a point where we're having people who are dropping out of the field, people who are otherwise well-qualified therapists, very effective in their work, dropping out of the field, not because they don't like it, not because they're not good at it, but because they can't afford the process of becoming a therapist. They can't make it through to licensure.
Right. I know of some cases like that in Sonoma County, as I said, where we're so saturated with therapists that they can't really, some people have not been able to make a living.
And yeah, so let me say actually a couple of things about that, about being saturated with therapists. Because I think, you know, a lot of therapists I talk with have this experience of, well, you know, it can't be that tough for therapists to be making a living because there are so many around me. And it's true that in urban areas, especially in California, there tend to be some very highly saturated areas of therapists. I did sort of an informal bar napkin math look at the numbers a couple of years ago and found that therapists actually tend to congregate not so much where people are as where money is.
Right. This has long been an issue. Yes.
But even if you're in an area that's heavily saturated, well, that makes it harder to compete. And if you're in an area that's not heavily saturated, it maybe makes it easier to compete with other therapists, but then you've got to make sure that you've got a practice that is accommodating enough to the clients who are around you that they will actually make the drive to come to your office. Neither situation is necessarily easy.
Yeah, part of that dynamic is because it's been around for a long time, at least for psychologists. It's been noticed that psychologists tended to practice in areas where they wanted to live, which were New York City, California, Florida, Colorado. Those are kind of the major ones. I don't know if those are still the major ones. Maybe Hawaii is there. I don't know.
I think you're right, though. I think all of that remains true today. Certainly, therapists tend to congregate in big cities, and especially in big cities where we would like to live.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of the discussion on a policy level about access to mental health care has been about how do we get access to people who are living in rural areas, which is critically important. But by simply adding professionals to the field, you don't necessarily improve rural access because you might just be adding more professionals who still want to live in big cities.
Yeah, right. Well, let's begin to look at some of the factors maybe that are playing into this decline of the use of therapy. What about the cost of therapy? It's always seemed to me to be pretty expensive, you know, particularly if you wanted to see somebody who had a fairly good reputation. To what extent do you think cost is a problem?
The cost is certainly a barrier to some people in accessing care. I mean, that's pretty well established in the literature. If you can't afford to see somebody licensed, then in some places you can go see somebody for free or for low cost in a in a clinic or training type setting, but not everybody has access to that. With insurance and with parity laws, kind of the hope was more people would have mental health covered, and then costs wouldn't be such an issue. One of the things we're seeing now with insurance coverage, though, is that a lot of plans have inadequate provider networks and maybe even not up-to-date information on who's in their plan, who's participating. Mm-hmm. So there's been, I think it's the one of the foundations, maybe the Kaiser Foundation, has had a fair amount of good coverage on this, where even if you have insurance that ostensibly covers mental health care, it can still be really tough to find a therapist. So cost is certainly a part of it. And we do know that overall, people are paying less on average per session than they were 10 years ago, and that's another sort of gradual decline, and that people are attending fewer sessions. In terms of what, how long a typical course of psychotherapy is, it's getting gradually shorter.
Mm-hmm. Just quickly, what do you think that's about? How are they getting shorter? Is that because they can only afford to go for a short period of time, or are therapies becoming more effective so that less time is needed?
I would really like to think that it's the latter, but I don't have strong evidence in support of that. So okay. I think part of it is cost, that people only go as long as they can afford to go. Part of it has been that, you know, over time, the influence of psychoanalysis on the larger field of psychotherapy has gotten sort of less and less and less. Not that it's not present in a significant way now, but it's just sort of decreasing. And as a result, you have fewer clients who are expecting to be in therapy for years and years. I think people often now come to therapy kind of wanting and expecting a short-term course of treatment. And then, you know, you can make this argument, I don't know how strong it is, but you can make this argument about people having been trained societally, having gotten the cultural message to expect a quick fix. That if therapy doesn't work in 6 to 12 sessions, then it's just not going to work for you, so stop going.
Okay.
Again, I don't have really strong data in support of that, but it's sort of in the air we breathe enough that I'm also not in a place to say that that's not impactful.
Okay. You suggest that many of us are professional organizations, or our professional organizations tend to rationalize the decline by blaming scapegoats, for example, Big Pharma. To what extent is Big Pharma to be blamed for or not blamed for this decline?
Oh, I know an awful lot of therapists who blame medication and blame physicians for a lot of the struggles that psychotherapists have and a lot of the struggle that psychotherapy overall is having. They say, you know, gosh, why are physicians just, you know, giving people pills for their depression and anxiety when we know that psychotherapy works so well? The thing is, while there has been, I think some improvement in coordination of care between therapists and physicians, it's a little bit hypocritical of us to want and expect physicians to refer to therapists for any mental health issue when at the same time, we often will say that physical symptoms should be treated with a mental health treatment. We don't necessarily cross-refer back to physicians either in the way that we probably should. It's also not all that well supported by survey data when we say that, you know, pills are responsible for all this, you know, decline in therapy. What clients are telling us isn't so much that. I mean, yes, there's a proportion of people who get medication treatment instead of therapy, and they want medication treatment instead of therapy, and that's fine. And some of what physicians are doing is just responding to what clients are saying. But for an awful lot of clients, they wind up seeking medication or using medication, not because they don't believe in therapy, but because they can't find a therapist that they like or who they think will actually be effective with them. That's a real problem for us.
Okay, yeah. We're going to get into that a bit more. What about the role of social stigma in terms of accounting for the decline?
It's tough to talk about stigma because there's been an awful lot of money rightfully put into anti-stigma campaigns. And if you look at sort of specific populations within the U.S. where there has been an historical and fully appropriate distrust of mental health professionals, fighting stigma is useful and important. On an overall level, though, stigma is not the reason why people don't go to therapy. In fact, when research has been done on people who considered therapy but then didn't go, and these people have been asked, why did you ultimately not go? If you felt like you were confident that you had a mental health need, you knew that therapists existed, why did you not actually seek help? Stigma is usually offered as an option, and it is at the bottom of the list. People instead worry about things like cost. They worry about things like access, and they worry about effectiveness. There is some degree of concern about stigma. And again, when you're talking about specific populations, it's appropriate to engage in sort of a fight against stigma. But if you look at what's overall sort of dragging down the field, stigma ain't it.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the role of movies and television in this discussion about the decline of the use of psychotherapy. How so? What role are they playing in this?
So I would specifically point people to Gabrielle Moore, who's been an intern of mine. She's going to be licensed in like 5 minutes, but she's been spending a lot of time looking at the influence of media messages on how people think about psychotherapy. And it's true that a lot of people only learn about therapy really from movies and TV. And movie and television depictions of therapists often depict us as unethical, ineffective. I mean, proportionally, you can imagine, if the proportion of therapists in life who were unethical matched the proportion of therapists on TV or in the movies who are unethical, our profession would be drummed out of town tomorrow. Because that's usually how we're portrayed. We're either entirely ineffective or unethical. Good portrayals of therapists are not that common.
My favorite one, it was Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting.
Yeah, actually, that's a pretty good portrayal of a therapist. And even in that movie, remember, he takes the main character by the collar at one point to say,
I forgot about it. I haven't watched it in a long time.
He says, if you, and I've forgotten the exact language, but if you sort of speak ill of my wife, I will end you.
Oh my goodness. Yes.
Remember that scene? And he's overall in the movie is a very good therapist. It's actually a portrayal I like a lot, but even in the midst of that,
Show
him doing something that I think most therapists would probably not do.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to agree. I've seen a lot of films and TV where the therapist, if not unethical, is kind of a bumbling fool in one way or another. That doesn't serve us well.
The Simpsons actually had a therapist on there a couple of times. He's got this gravelly voice, Dr. Marvin Monroe.
Good job.
Bumbling idiot, right? But also funny. I really hope that that's not how people think of family therapists.
Yeah, yeah. Great. I love your imitation of it. I got the feel of it right away. So what do you see as the risks that the psychotherapy professions are facing as a result of this decline and so on?
Well, in brief, the risk that we run, and we are already on this path, is becoming a profession by and for the wealthy, where you don't go to therapy unless you are independently wealthy and can afford it sort of as a luxury, and you don't become a therapist unless you are independently wealthy and you can afford it as a luxury.
Yeah. Okay. That says it. Well, you place the burden of turning things around on the professional associations, but even more so on the individual psychotherapist. How so? What can an individual therapist do in the face of large systemic forces outside their direct control?
That's a fantastic question, and that's actually why I wrote the book. I think for a lot of therapists, you see what's going on around you, the larger picture of the profession, and it can be discouraging. because it feels like so much of it is out of your hands, and you sort of hope that professional associations and licensing boards and other people will sort of take care of things for you. And it's easy to lose track of a couple of things. Number one, the amount of power that you actually yourself have to change the community, to change the psychotherapy field through what you do in practice. And number two, we lose sight of the fact that the professional associations are us. They speak for us. They do what they do at our direction. So if you don't like a direction that the association is taking, you can get involved and you can actually help change the direction that it takes.
Okay, good. So you don't just leave us hanging with this problem, with the downward, the long downward glide of the profession. You actually say there are five tasks that individual therapists and professional associations need to take on in order to save psychotherapy. So maybe we can move through each of those five and drill down on them. The first one is to clarify our purposes and values. I always resist that. I don't know. It seems like there are all these different things that want me to look at my values. I probably need to go to therapy about that.
Well, I'll say, I think a lot of us get trained to discount our own values in the therapy process. And so I think for many of us, it's that's just an exercise of our training to say, well, why are you asking me about my values? My values should not be important in this context. So that's actually understandable to me that you'd be reluctant to bring your values in. But what I think winds up happening is that we get some direction on values from our professions, but actually not very much, and not enough that either we or the people we serve can really tell the difference between a clinical social worker, a counselor, a psychologist, and an MFT. We all seem to be sort of serving the same ends when it's even clear who we're serving. And I'll give you an example that is at least a little bit controversial. This idea of emotional support animals on airplanes. So people use them for airplanes and housing predominantly, that if you get a letter from a therapist that says, you know, so-and-so needs this animal to manage their anxiety in their housing situation or on a flight. Normally, pets wouldn't be allowed in those situations. But with a letter supporting an emotional support animal, somebody can do it, can have a pet in housing or can take an animal on board a flight. Well, as a profession, as a field, we haven't really answered the question of, to whom are we primarily responsible? Because if we're primarily responsible to our client, to the person who is paying us, then it makes sense if you come to me and you say, Ben, I'm going to take a flight next week. I'm a little bit anxious about flying. I'd really like to bring my pet pig on board. Can I bring my pet pig on board? Well, if I'm serving you, then... And if I'm convinced that actually having the pet pig on board would help your anxiety around flying a little bit, then I'm going to write the letter. And I'm going to say, I hope this helps, and to whatever degree it does, fantastic. But what about everybody else on that plane who might be annoyed, allergic, or in some other way, you know, frightened or bothered by that animal being on board the plane? Do I have any responsibility at all to those other people to say, actually, we need to find some other ways to manage your anxiety because you have to live in the world and people are going to be annoyed by a pig on an airplane? And there actually have been a couple of stories, by the way, in the news about people who brought pigs on airplanes as emotional support animals. Sometimes uneventfully, sometimes eventfully.
Wow.
But we don't really get guidance from our professions, from our code of ethics, from our training, really, about who that primary responsibility is to. And so for a client, and I talk about this in the context of couple and family treatment often as well, you know, with a couple, if I have somebody who's coming in for couple therapy, they don't always necessarily know, unless I tell them at first, here's what I believe about whether and how relationships should stay together versus breaking apart. And often people seek out a couple therapists hesitantly, not knowing whether that therapist is going to be as committed to saving the relationship, or frankly, as uncommitted to saving the relationship as the client is. Mm-hmm. So this lack of clarity around what our values are as a field and as individual therapists really hurts us in the eyes of the public, who distrust us, understandably. I use the metaphor in the book of, imagine getting into a taxi blindfolded and just trusting that the cab driver is going to take you where you want to go. Most of us probably wouldn't.
Right, right. Well, I love your example of the pig and this question of who do we serve, and also bringing in family therapy into it, because it used to be that the track record for family therapy wasn't all that great, with a very large proportion ending up in divorce. Mm-hmm. And you know, and I think in part that's because there wasn't this clarity that you're asking for. And actually, I think the research that I'm thinking of goes back to more to individual therapists who somebody would come with a troubled marital relationship or couple relationship in individual therapy. And so that therapist feels like their commitment is to that person, rather than thinking outside that box and saying, wait a second, there's a whole system going on here. My duty is to that larger group.
Yeah, Bill Doherty wrote this great book a few years ago called Soul Searching, about sort of therapists and moral responsibility, and how we bring the client's sense of moral responsibility into session. And he talks about how psychotherapy for years has been sort of rightly accused of encouraging this ethos of expressive individualism. To say, you know, if you've got a client who comes in distress and they're thinking of leaving their job or their marriage or their family or whatever else, then we basically tell them, oh, well, you need to go find your spirit animal or whatever. As opposed to, you have responsibility to these people. So let's talk about how you can be happier in life, fulfill your obligations in such a way that when the time comes that you're on your deathbed, you can actually look back on and be proud. As opposed to just go find yourself and be happy. You know, finding yourself and being happy is fantastic, but it maybe shouldn't always be the short-term goal of therapy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You say the various professional associations haven't been good at clarifying their values to the public, but I was also very interested in your observation that they've been too inward-facing. In other words, a lot of their publications and policies, ethics and so on, have been more directed towards meeting our needs as therapists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the associations have had a focus, which is understandable. My intention here is not to sort of cast aspersions. I understand where this comes from. As an association, you want to make sure that you're going to continue to get members and continue to be alive as an association. But where that thinking has led them is all about member service and sort of member recruitment. So we wind up with you know, a lot of debates about the value proposition of membership. And I've been sort of around association circles long enough to hear a lot of this kind of talk where they talk about, you know, how can you convince people that you are going to get your 200 and some odd dollars worth? And I think that's the wrong math. That's not why we join professional associations, at least not most of the therapists that I know. It's not so much the value proposition of getting my 200 and some dollars worth. It's more about, I want to be part of an organization with a defined mission where my presence and my dues have a meaningful impact and get us closer to achieving that mission. And quite honestly, for a lot of the associations right now, they're not in a great place to talk about what they are trying to achieve other than being good for the profession. So I will make one exception to that, though. because I have admired the nerve of NASW, the National Association of Social Workers. They have been, I think, far more willing to court controversy, far more willing to take public stances that are in keeping with the scientific literature in that field. That shows me that they believe in all of what they're based on, as opposed to, APA has certainly gone through its share of hard times after the Hoffman Report. ACA and AAMFT.
You better say something about the Hoffman Report. Nobody will know what you're talking about here.
Oh, sorry, that's a good point. So the APA for years had psychologists who were involved, embedded with the military, yeah, and with the torture of military detainees overseas. The APA has now for a few years been trying to unwind that, and as part of unwinding it, they did an investigation into how did we sort of wind up here in the first place. And the Hoffman Report was this investigatory report that found just how closely the APA had been tied in with the Department of Defense. Now, they didn't find any sort of bribery or any of that kind of thing, but what they did find was that in order to sort of court the Department of Defense, to continue to provide employment opportunities for psychologists, right? It's this self-interest thing, that they made rules around psychologists' involvement in torture that were never any more strict than what the Department of Defense wanted. And they even sort of coordinated how those rules were set, while at the same time telling the public we have these very strong rules in place, which wasn't really true in effect. So the Hoffman Report kind of laid that out for people. A number of APA folks resigned in the wake of that report. Some were removed from their positions, I think. And they've just gone through a lot of transitions since then, and they've kind of updated their ethics code and so forth. But it was this really unfortunate example of how an association's self-interest, their desire just to provide more money, more employment for psychologists, led it to stop serving the larger community, the public, in a meaningful way. And our mission, at least as I see it, and I think I can trace this back effectively to the origins of each of the professions, our mission should really be more about community service. And the associations have a wonderful role to play in sharing the collected knowledge of the profession with the community. That we're not doing all that well right now.
Well, so one of your charges to the individual psychotherapists is, as you mentioned earlier, is to get more active in their associations and realize that their association is them, mm-hmm, and to get involved in that. And the other is to join, if they're not already in the association, so that the association has the money in order to institute the public-facing programs that need to be there.
Yeah, and
because their income's going down too, as you indicated, the professions are, their income.
Yeah, memberships in the associations are declining. They're all sort of fighting against this sense of, you know, they're going to have more people retiring than are coming into the field.
Yeah.
And that understandably leads to a kind of mindset of organizational self-preservation. But I really think it's important for people not to write off their associations for that reason, and not to fail to join for that reason, but actually to go ahead and join for the right reasons that you want to be part of this meaningful mission, and then force the association from within to exercise that mission, to go in the direction that we collectively would like them to go, to serve the larger community, to aspire to social change based on what we have learned in our fields. It breaks my heart a bit with what we know now about violence in general and gun violence in particular, that the associations in mental health, again with the exception of NASW, have not gotten more involved in policy issues surrounding violence and violence prevention, including gun control. That seems like a very natural place where, we know that the risk of suicide is significantly higher when people have a gun in the home. Why are our voices nowhere to be heard when policy debates come up around, is it ever okay to remove the guns from someone's home? We absolutely should be at that table.
And probably a major reason why we're not at a lot of those tables is that these are political issues. And so for an organization to take a political stand, they risk alienating some maybe large portion of the public.
Well, that's no doubt. I think that's absolutely true. That is the risk that you run. If you take a political stand, you risk alienating folks, including sometimes your own members.
Yeah,
and that's why definitely. The organizations need to be thoughtful about the kinds of stances they take.
Yeah.
But they wind up taking them anyway. They do it sort of cautiously, and often they're late to the party. But if you look at issues like same-sex marriage, well, each of the associations wound up taking a stand on that issue. Unfortunately, for most of them, they took a stand at a time when it didn't require any courage to do so. When the knowledge, the sort of scientific knowledge necessary to base a stand on, had been well established for a long
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
Once we've got that scientific knowledge, and admittedly, science is not perfect, and sometimes as the science grows and adapts, we need to change our views. But when the scientific knowledge is in place to say, this is what our field should be doing, we should have the courage to follow through on that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, moving along, another major task area that you outline is to fix therapist training. In what ways is therapist training broken?
Oh, my gosh.
Let me count the ways.
Yeah. We train people for too long in ways that have not been proven to impact therapeutic outcomes whatsoever. There have been a number of studies over a number of years. There's usually one big meta-analytic study every decade or so that keeps showing the same thing. What they keep showing is that after about that first year of clinical experience, on average, our outcomes don't get better. Now, that's not to say that we suck. We don't. We're really good at what we do. It just means that after that first year, more experience doesn't make us more effective. We tend to plateau at a really pretty effective place.
That's kind of surprising. You would think that experience would count for more than that.
Well, that's why we keep studying this over and over and over again in 100 different ways, and we keep finding the same thing.
Huh.
The things that make people effective aren't experience in and of itself. And the best parallel I can give you for why that is true is I'm in Los Angeles, right? Those of us in Los Angeles drive all the freaking time. We're always on the road. That's why the roads are so crowded. We drive a lot. If experience made us more effective, then Los Angeles would have the best drivers in the world because we do so much driving here. But what winds up happening with driving and with therapy and with just about any other skill set, and again, great research on this, we reach a level that what we would call functional adequacy, and we stop trying to get better because mm-hmm. we feel like how we are is good enough. It's working. When I make the drive down to my office, I'm not trying to become a better driver along the way. Same with therapy. So after about that first year, people seem to reach a level of functional adequacy, and they stop doing the things that actually do make us better. And Scott Miller's got a great amount of research on, you know, what can continue to make us better after that point, deliberate practice and so forth. But most of us, most of the time, that first year is what gets us to a really good, effective level. And that begs the question, why on earth are we having people in longer and longer and longer degree programs, at least at the master's level, and then requiring them to do, you know, 2 to 6 years of supervised experience before we allow them to practice independently, when by and large, they're not getting better in that time.
It's really changed, I must say, since my days back in the age of the dinosaurs, where, I spent 2 years getting a master's degree and then another six getting a PhD, so that by the time I finally got through that process, I was pretty far away from that young, idealistic person who really wanted to work with people and felt like I could do good work. And now I was a lot more in my head than in my heart, maybe.
That's still commonly true now. I think, you know, a lot of folks who do a doctorate degree, you're talking about 2 or 3 years for a master's, and then another, depending on, you know, how somebody does it, another probably 3 to 6 for a doctoral degree. And a lot of that time just doesn't seem to be making a difference. And when we talk about psychology graduates, who now, the average person who gets their PsyD from a clinical psychology program now graduates with $200,000 of educational debt. Yeah. That is bananas, especially considering how little of that is actually probably necessary, that they would have been just as good, just as effective with their clients with less training and less expense.
Somehow I'm thinking of barefoot doctors. Maybe we need a kind of equivalent of the. I just have that phrase in my mind. I don't even remember all the details, but people with very minimal medical training who can go out into rural areas in third world countries and do a lot of good.
Yeah. Well, and on a professional level, it's kind of happening with therapy now, where we're seeing growth in the use of trained peer counselors, and we're seeing growth in the regulation of applied behavior analysis, and we're seeing, you know, more states who are licensing substance use counselors, where those are sort of lower levels of licensure. They require less training. That's why a lot of states like them. And they have a scope of practice that at least includes some of the things that therapists would have been doing before. Now, you get some risk where if you try to lower the licensure standards for one group of therapists, then the other professions can all point to them and say, see, they've got less training, you should hire us instead. So some of this is absolutely politics and turf and all that. But there are still things we can do to fix the process that don't necessarily trigger those kinds of fights. And just as an example, quickly, what we've done in California in the past year or so here, we changed the structure of licensure for counselors and for family therapists so that you still have to get 3,000 hours total. But you used to have to do all these different categories, buckets, as our licensing board likes to call them, all these different categories of hours for licensure that were really hard to keep track of. And if you finished out a category, it's not like your employer would say, okay, stop doing that kind of work. You still had to do it. You just now couldn't count it for licensure. We really streamlined the process so that people will be able to get licensed a little bit faster while still doing 3,000 hours. And I know for psychologists, they've been trying to get rid of the postdoc intern year, and they've been successful doing that in some states. The argument that they've been making is that within the degree program, you already get about 3,000 hours of experience. So those kinds of steps are, I think, movement in the right direction, where hopefully we're not burdening somebody with years and years and years of additional expensive training and additional time not yet being licensed. That, again, pushes some people out of the field.
Yeah. Do you think graduate programs are churning out too many therapists?
That's a really tough question. It's a surprisingly difficult question to answer, even sort of objectively, because when therapists age out, we don't tend to retire all at once. We tend to sort of go to part-time and then a little bit less part-time and then, you know, so forth. And then you look at, like we were talking about before, these areas that are saturated with therapists versus rural areas that have no therapists whatsoever. Well, if you put out more therapists, they're probably actually going to continue to go to the urban areas. So on a raw numbers level, frankly, I don't know. What I can tell you, I think, with a little more confidence, is that The private universities that are relying on student loans to fund their students through their programs, they tend to be a lot more expensive than public universities. I will say I'm worried about the degrees to which some of those programs are going to market themselves to prospective students without doing a ton to protect those students from falling out part way. I think we have a real issue with students who come into a program and online as well as on ground. This happens in both settings. They take out loans to start a graduate program because the program has effectively recruited them in with all these promises of what a great profession it is and how successful you can be. They really struggle educationally for whatever reason. They drop out. They don't actually become a therapist. And in addition to now not being able to get the license, they're now saddled with all this educational debt that the university has no responsibility for. So they don't have to worry about it. That is a concern that I have in terms of numbers. I wish that universities were spending a little bit less on marketing and recruitment and a little bit more on faculty and educational quality.
Yeah, there's some concern that I and some of my people that I talk to, colleagues, older colleagues, and I don't know if this is an accurate perception or not, but that some of these private freestanding graduate schools pretty much would accept anybody who can pony up the money.
Oh yeah, pulse in a checkbook. There are absolutely programs that if you meet those two requirements, a pulse and a checkbook, they will take you in. Mm-hmm. I talked with a colleague from one institution a couple of years ago who was proud to say that they had just instituted admissions interviews. That before that, they wouldn't even interview people for admission. And that's... Wow. That's unfortunately kind of the state of things. When it's a competitive, in many instances, for-profit environment, the way that you make money is by admitting people. You don't make money by turning them away.
Yeah. What about licensing exams? You are pretty critical. You say that they are ineffective. I've been through a few myself, and tell us.
Yeah, they don't do what they are advertised as doing, or at least there's no evidence to say that they do what they're advertised as doing. They are ostensibly for public safety, that they would protect the public from incompetent practitioners. The reality is that, number one, almost everybody passes. And so for the master's level professions in California, if you just stay in the process long enough, there's a greater than 90-something percent chance you're going to pass. So,
take it more than once, right, if you don't pass it the first time.
Yeah, if you fail it the first time, you take it again in a few months. And there's no limit. You can keep taking the test indefinitely as long as you're willing to wait out the waiting period each time. So almost everybody passes. And the people who don't pass, there is no evidence anywhere that the people who don't pass a licensing exam are unsafe as practitioners. What there is evidence of is that the people who don't pass a licensing exam either don't have English as their first language, or they have pretty significant test anxiety. We know that licensing exams will impact in a negative way the diversity of a field without impacting the overall effectiveness of that field. And that's really worrisome. When we're trying to diversify the mental health profession so that our professions look more like the communities we serve, our licensing exams seem to actively fight against that without a corresponding benefit. They're like TSA at the airport. They're security theater.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the test anxiety, and that triggered, I have a good friend who I've been in a men's group with for many, many, many years, who went through all the training, got the master's degree, could not pass the test due to test anxiety. Yeah. He would be a wonderful therapist. You know, he's so warm and accessible, etc. It's just a shame. And I didn't know that might be a wider spread issue than my one friend.
Oh, absolutely. That there are plenty of people who are in that boat who, they actually have the knowledge and the skill, and they get into the exam room which of course looks nothing like therapy. They get into the exam room and then they kind of freeze up.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate. We lose good people from the field for that reason.
Yeah. Well, we're in danger of running out of time pretty soon here, but I don't want to let you go without discussing the third task that you set for therapy, which is to embrace science. Mm-hmm. And that seems like something that a lot of lip service is given to.
Oh, I couldn't have said it better.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I know a lot of therapists who really like to say that we are part of a scientific field, but when the rubber hits the road, they actually take a pretty anti-scientific stance in the work that they do. Mm-hmm. They work with a new client on a new problem they haven't dealt with before, and they don't ever bother to check the literature to see kind of what's the current standard of care for that problem. Or they take an approach to therapy that has no scientific basis for it. Even the common factors researchers, the people who are sort of behind this movement that says every theoretical model in therapy is basically working on the same stuff, just with different language for it. There's good reason to get on board with that common factors movement, but even the common factors folks say you need to be working from an established model in therapy. And their rationale is that models are like maps, that you can have a roadmap or a weather map or a topographic map or any other kind of map. And these are all just different theoretical models. And they will tell you kind of where you are right now, where you started, how far you are from your destination, and where you need to go next, sort of where to go from here. If you try to do therapy without a model or without a map, then you're just going to be lost. You're just going to wander, and you're actually going to waste a lot of time in therapy on things that don't get you any closer to the destination. And I think we have a fair number of therapists who either out of a stance of eclecticism, and I might even say sort of faux eclecticism, but some kind of anti-theoretical model stance, they wind up wandering in therapy. And I'll tell you, I was also part of a discussion on social media just the other day, where the question had come up about sort of these unsubstantiated diagnoses, things that people throw around in the field that aren't in the DSM and that don't seem to have much basis in the literature. And on one hand, a lot of diagnoses get started because, you know, people notice them and they document them and they see, okay, this set of symptoms seems to go together. And that's fine. That's sort of the natural scientific process. But when we throw around terms that are not established, that are experimental, and we don't appropriately contextualize them that way, we wind up sort of degrading the field by making it appear that diagnosis itself is meaningless or unscientific. And there's reason to criticize the DSM, but not reason to entirely throw out diagnosis, its importance or its place. There are a number of therapists who take a pretty anti-science stance, which, if you want to do that on an individual level, is troubling to me because I share a profession, but if you want to do it on an individual level in your practice, there's a reluctant part of me that says, okay, but for heaven's sake, don't say that our field is unscientific and don't try to discourage us from making scientific progress in how we assess and diagnose and treat people, because that gives us respectability in the public eye, with other professions, in the policy world. They want us to be accountable for our work and for the basis of our work. And when we say, oh, you know, therapy is really just an art, or when we say, oh, the DSM is just nonsense, or when we say any of these other things that therapists say that are grossly anti-scientific, a therapist two blocks down saying that hurts your practice, hurts my practice, hurts our ability to get into government programs. It hurts the entire field.
Okay, well, that's a good, strong statement. And I guess reluctantly, since we've gone for an hour, I'm going to reluctantly draw it to a close. But hopefully we've whet people's appetite to get your book, which I really strongly recommend. As a matter of fact, I've got my copy right here. And I think this book, any therapist of whatever licensure in school really should have this book and go through it. And I think you're doing a great service to the field. So,
well, thank you so much. I appreciate being here. It's an honor to hear you talk about the book that way. And yeah, as you can tell, I could talk about this stuff for hours.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll find some other reasons to talk in the future. Dr. Ben Caldwell, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Dr. Dave, thank you very much.
I have to say, Dr. Ben Caldwell impresses me as one sharp cookie. You recall that we started off with his assertion that psychotherapy works incredibly well. He said there's a ton of research that has been accumulating over the years to this effect. He didn't mention the work of Dr. Scott D. Miller in the interview at this point, but he did cite the example of psychotherapy being more effective than aspirin is for preventing heart attacks. I believe that example, in fact, comes from Dr. Miller. I recall Dr. Miller using it in a very impressive presentation I attended some years back. Ben does cite the work of Dr. Scott Miller later in the book. Dr. Miller is one of those clinical researchers whose work has helped to establish the effectiveness of psychotherapy. In fact, if you haven't heard my interview with him, I would strongly recommend you listen to Shrink Wrap Radio, episode number 66, What Really Works in Therapy with Scott D. Miller, Ph.D. There was a long period in which the effectiveness of psychotherapy was not so well established. Various research studies showed that it was not more effective than being on the waiting list to see a therapist or more effective than psychotropic medications. That story changed when researchers began to distinguish between good therapists and bad therapists. Let's face it, there are good mechanics and bad mechanics, good plumbers and bad plumbers, good electricians and bad electricians. Similarly, there are good psychotherapists and bad psychotherapists. When you filter out the bad psychotherapists, it turns out that psychotherapy is quite effective. Dr. Caldwell visits this topic in some depth in his book. In the interview, you heard him say that experience generally does not equate to excellence. He also said that many therapists plateau after reaching a certain level of comfort in their practice. Dr. Caldwell challenges therapists to move beyond that comfort level to excellence. He has specific recommendations, which include getting ongoing supervision, seeking specialized training, concentrating on the goal of getting better. And beyond this, again echoing Dr. Scott Miller, he urges therapists to solicit feedback from their clients as to the client's perception of the therapist and their satisfaction in terms of progressing toward their goals. There are specific assessment forms that therapists can use after every session or at periodic intervals. It takes courage to take this step, but Drs. Caldwell and Miller both assert this can only strengthen the quality of services that we offer and ultimately raise the public image of psychotherapy. As you heard me say at the end of the interview, I think this is a book that every therapist should read and have on their bookshelf. By the way, did I mention the book is very well written with a seamless blending of self-disclosure, personal stories, and coverage of scientific research findings, all in less than 200 pages? As always, you're encouraged to order Saving Psychotherapy, How Therapists Can Bring the Talking Cure Back from the Brink, by Benjamin Caldwell, using our Amazon affiliate widget in the right-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Jim Wagner in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I am just finishing my degree in marriage and family therapy, and am happy to contribute to your podcast. Shrink Wrap Radio has been a huge benefit and continues to be a huge benefit to my education. I'm so grateful for the work you're doing. Please continue to keep it up. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks so much to you, Jim Wagner. I really appreciate your support. If you're not already a financial supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio, I hope you'll join Jim as a donor. As I mentioned at the beginning, we do have a relatively new sponsor, Bombas Socks. I've been an ongoing customer of theirs for several years. Why? Because of the bright colors and distinctive patterns. That's certainly one of the major reasons. You might not believe this, but I'm actually a bit of an introvert. And one of the ways that I compensate for that sometimes is to wear very bright colors. It's a way of, making a statement without actually speaking. And of course, the other great thing about Bombas is their philanthropic commitment to providing a pair of socks to a homeless person for every pair that you order. So if you're a listener in the U.S., you can save 20% off your first order by going to getbombas.com/shrinkwrapradio. And Bombas is spelled B-O-M-B-A-S. Once again, if you are a user of our Shrink Wrap Radio app, you may have noticed that I've resumed putting up short video previews a day or so before the next interview. I hope you're enjoying and appreciating that extra effort on my part. If you don't have our app, it is available for all smartphones. Just go to the Apps tab at Shrink Wrap Radio for full information. And remember, you can find both the video preview and the full video of the interview on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/shrinkwrapradio. Evidently, there are people out there who prefer that medium, video, and who have been subscribing to my YouTube channel. Due to some changes at the Zur Institute, I've not been able to offer any new CE courses for some time. Of course, my courses that are there are timeless. So please remember, you can get 10% off on all the APA continuing education materials at the Zur Institute, not just the courses based on my interviews. You can click on that banner in our left-hand sidebar, or simply go to Zur Institute, that's Z-U-R, Institute.com, and search through their extensive catalog of more than 100 courses, and then use my discount code at checkout, which is DrDave88.
Hi, this is Dr. John Arden, psychologist, workshop leader, author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. John Arden, who was a guest here twice in the past. You might check him out on episode number 389, The Brain Bible with John B. Arden, PhD, and Shrink Wrap Radio number 332, The Emerging Psychotherapeutic Consensus with John B. Arden, PhD. Now, let's go to a recent email from our listener community, and it's from Andy, who writes, "Have you ever thought about getting Roger Brook on your show? His book, Jung and Phenomenology, is a great read, and I would love to hear more of his thoughts." And that's from Andy Carnahan. Well, Andy, no, I never thought about inviting Roger Brook because I was unaware of him. Thanks for your suggestion, which I will take into consideration. And with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can also leave voicemail using our app or on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks again to today's guest, Dr. Ben Caldwell, for alerting us to some of the dangers and challenges psychotherapy is facing. My next interview will be with return guest, noted Jungian analyst and author, Dr. Arel Shalit, and we'll be discussing Eric Neumann's work on the collective symbolism of the brother motif. This will be of particular interest to all you Jungians out there. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.